Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the New Book Network podcast. I'm Deidre Tyler. Today we'll be talking with M.K. Beecham, Associate Professor of History at Rogers State University and author of Instruments of Empire, Colonial Elites and U.S. Governance in Early National Louisiana, 1803 to 1815. How are you doing today, Professor?
I'm well. How are you?
Great. Can you start by telling us a little about yourself and how you became interested in this project?
Sure. Yeah, I'm from Lubbock, Texas originally, and went to the University of Dallas for my BA, and then I was at Texas A&M doing a master's degree. And my master's thesis was on Aaron Burr conspiracy stuff, and I don't know, having directed a couple master's theses, I mean, they either go one or two ways, but one way is they're really good, and that becomes sort of a chapter or the stepping stone for the dissertation later or the book, or they go really badly, and mine was more the second. But, you know, sort of taught you what not to do, but one of the things my advisor told me is, like, look, there's a lot of stuff about major figures in Louisiana here, and there's probably more to do on that. So that was sort of my entree into Louisiana, and I had family in New Orleans, so you'd visit, and you were always fascinated by it. So, and, you know, this was, I don't know, 2002, 2003, starting to work on that, and then finished the dissertation in 2009, and very different, and that, you know, sort of it was comparing different regions in Louisiana rather than sort of the format it has now. And then, you know, I'd send it off to individuals to read, and they'd say, well, you know, this is interesting, but you probably need to put more about how this is not just Louisiana history, that this is American history, that, you know, this is very similar to stuff that's happening elsewhere. And, you know, when I put that in the introduction and then sent it off to the press, not surprisingly, it came back and they'd say, well, okay, look, you need to do more on that. So, you know, back to the drawing board. And then finally, you know, 10 years later, you know, I you know, sent it back in, and they were willing to publish it. It takes me a long time to do anything, but it finally got done.
Now, you started the book talking about James Workman. Tell us a story about him and how he played a role in understanding Louisiana.
Yeah, so Workman's interesting. He's, you know, he's a British immigrant to the United States, and he's a Federalist. He's not a Republican. He's not someone that's sort of a natural fit for getting patronage in Louisiana. When Jefferson comes in 1801, you know, they're going to steer patronage to members of that party. But, you know, Workman was a big advocate of the U.S. takeover of Louisiana. And he wrote a play that sort of, you know, in very kind of over-the-top fiction sort of demonstrated sort of what he saw as the evils of Spanish colonialism as opposed to, you know, sort of the more beneficent attributes of the United States. And, you know, then got a position as a judge. And, Workman then found himself at odds during the Burr conspiracy when General James Wilkinson came in and started to make arrests, extra legal arrests in Workman's view. Workman started to let these guys out, and Workman ended up getting arrested himself and eventually, losing his judgeship over it. So, and Workman sort of, a type, and that there's a lot of individuals like that from Britain, from France, from the Caribbean coming in that get appointments, that have sort of this ability to get entree based on that, that sometimes have higher trust even than sort of local Creoles who might, be suspect in ways that sort of, Frenchmen from elsewhere or British, or former British subjects like Workman were not.
Now, explain to the audience the complex racial mixture of Louisiana that makes it really interesting to study.
Yeah, so it's inordinately complex, and sometimes too much so, and that you sometimes create these sort of discrete categories in your mind that don't necessarily work on the ground. So you're talking about Anglo-Americans coming in who are used to a very rigid racial kind of categorization of white free, black slave in general, right? To be sure, there's small free black populations in the South and places like Charleston, but not on the same level they're going to find in New Orleans. So when Americans come into New Orleans, they're encountering a much more significant, large free black population And that, too, is kind of a catch-all term, right? You're sometimes talking about people that are both African-American and indigenous or triracial, And so that's something that often Anglo-Americans from the rest of the South coming in struggle with or have a hard time getting their heads around. You're also talking about this long period under the Spanish that had allowed for freedoms to take place, far more so than the French, right? The Code Noir, the French, was never really enforced in the way it was supposed to be in Louisiana. So you had a far more, for lack of a better word, sort of liberal racial regime under the Spanish than you had under the French. And, that led to the growth of this free black population. And you have these, during the American Revolution, when Galvez is the Spanish governor, you have free black militia units, right? A unit of Pardos and a unit of Merinos. So, there's a lot of, distinctions being made by the Spanish that get obscured when the Americans come in. It's also interesting that you don't want to read this as just Anglo-American imposition of their racial ideology, in the sense that there's a lot of white Creoles, white elites in Louisiana, French speakers that were very unhappy with the way the Spanish had allowed this to take place. They want more access to slaves. They're not particularly comfortable with those free black militia units or companies. So, this sometimes is read as sort of Anglo-American imposition of their racial ideology. And there's an element of truth to that, but there's also a lot of white elite Creoles pushing for this too, right? In some ways, this is one of the ways in which the United States is getting support. So when you see something like, a colonial legislature that has a lot of French speakers in it in 1806 passing the Black Code, that's not, on high from Washington, right? In some ways, I mean, I don't want to say that's bottom up because it's not, but it's middle up, or it's, sort of elite or local elite up, forming something like that that's, then restricting, not just the abilities or the freedoms of slaves, but it's restricting, the growth of the free black population in Louisiana.
Now, define Creole for the audience.
Yeah, this is, you would ask me about this. This is a complex question. And on the one hand, in sort of a Spanish Atlantic or Spanish imperial context, Creole just meant Spaniards born in the New World, right? So to distinguish them from Peninsulares, Spaniards coming in from abroad. So it's a term that has to do with pedigree, right? Saying that these are Spaniards or Europeans born in the New World. That's what it meant initially. Now, this is a big question too, because you don't exactly have pseudo-scientific kind of racial categories really, you know, in a, or when those come in, right? Is that the 18th century? Is it the 17th century? You know, it doesn't really seem like it's the 16th century when you're talking about, you know, New Spain. So, but at first this has to do with pedigree, but increasingly it becomes a kind of racial category. Now, and that's why in some ways it's not, it's a confusing term because it's changing in history consistently. So when I'm using it, that's generally how I'm using it, right? I'm using it as locals in Louisiana born. Now, over time in Louisiana, it comes to mean basically French speakers, right? I mean, you know, this is in white and black. And this too is a complex question because you sometimes have members of the African-American community do not like people that use that term because they feel like that's, you know, failing to identify blackness, or you're not identifying with blackness. You sometimes have racial politics the other way, Creoles that don't want to be called that because they fear it has a racial connotation that it may or may not. So it very much depends on who's saying it, who's writing it, what time they're writing it in, and to get it what that means. But you know, I think certainly by the 20th century in Louisiana, it can just mean French speakers, white, black, indigenous. But you got to be careful with that. For my period, or when you're talking about early national Louisiana, it's not always that useful a term in that the Creole identity, or that Creole identity that becomes just French speakers, needs Americanization, because there's no identity before that in terms of a broader Creole identity in Louisiana, Louisiana's colonial period, or at least that's Joseph Tregel thought that, right? There's this book, Creole New Orleans, that the Tregel had an essay in where he talks about, you know, it's not really all that important a category in the colonial era, because identity is positive in the sense that, you know, you're you and I'm me because we're, you know, A, B, C, D, and we've all got all these special categories. But identity is also negative. It's by what you're not. So it's not until the Americans come in that you start to see this broader Creole category of all French speakers, again, revolving around language and the importance of that for this process of community formation, or sort of imagined communities, right, to borrow Benedict Anderson's term. So it's a really complex term that, you know, you got to think about, well, wait, who's saying it? What do they mean by that? When I'm using it, I'm usually meaning that to mean locals born in Louisiana, and generally, you know, white Creoles. And if it's something else, I identify it there. But, you know, for that early territorial period, I'm not sure there's really a Creole identity in the way there comes to be one later. And that you're talking about, you know, Acadians in Louisiana that do not identify as Creole. I was listening to your podcast last week where they're talking about how, well, no, Cajuns and Creoles would sometimes get offended in the 20th century if you referred to one or the other that way, right? I mean, so you've got this Acadian population. You've got, you know, what later came to be called the foreign French, but you've got Frenchmen coming in from France. They're not really Creoles in the sense that they're not locals. They don't identify as locals, and Anglo-Americans don't identify them as locals or see them as locals. You've got Frenchmen who sometimes spent time on the East Coast of the United States and then immigrate to Louisiana. You've got Acadians, likewise, who spent time in other states or in the Caribbean. You've got Frenchmen coming in, or French speakers coming in from, you know, Saint-Domingue or Haiti, or they get exiled to Cuba. They're coming in from there. And those people, you know, all have different politics too, right? Some of them might be French Republicans. Some of them might be Bonapartists. Some of them might be royalists. So Yeah, when you're looking at sort of that French-speaking community in, say, 1805 and saying, well, this is all a Creole population, well, yeah, probably not. And it's really interesting because the incoming governor, Governor Claiborne, he doesn't usually use the word Creole. He usually will use the word ancient inhabitants or former inhabitants to talk about, you know, people there before the Americans came in, right? To talk about French and Spanish speakers, but maybe not too, right? At some points, Claiborne might be referring to Anglo-Americans already in Louisiana, but had been there for 10, 20, 30 years. So this is one of these questions too. So when you talk about, well, who's a local and who's not, well, you know, say some, you know, an Irishman who'd been in New Orleans since 1780 and had, you know, married into the local population, because you've got a lot of exogamous marriages taking place between these populations consistently. You know, is he a local? Is he not? You know, you probably wouldn't identify him as a Creole, but you certainly wouldn't identify him as one of these Americans coming in 25 years later either. So, you know, it's really hard to just typecast these people into groups. And when I get to that last chapter and looking at appointments, that's a big question. Well, wait, is this guy a Creole? Is he not a Creole? Is he local? Is he not? I mean, they don't, you know, fit into sort of a Venn diagram the way you want them to often in terms of, you know, oh, this is their type or this is their, you know, their pedigree.
Now, many times it's good to listen and understand what outsiders are saying about an area. You talked about Darby and how he observed Louisiana. Tell us about that.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the, you know, sort of natural historians or geographers and people like Darby offer, and likewise C.C. Robin, they offer a more honest view. I mean, I think you're right. There's a lot to be said for the fresh eyes or the outsider coming in, because that's someone who doesn't have a stake in any of this necessarily, right? They might have their own biases, of course, but you know, their living probably doesn't depend on, you know, how they want to see, the transition from Spain to France to the United States, and you know, individuals like Darby give you these kind of, sort of view from Mars kind of perspective that I really appreciate. And again, Robin likewise and others, I think there's a lot of use to be made from these kind of travelers or journalers coming through. And, you know, the fresh eyes too. I mean, I think that's always worthwhile, and that, I love Louisiana history, but it sometimes can get very inside baseball. And that's sort of one of the things I was trying to, by making the comparisons, bring out. Well, look, Louisiana is unique. Of course it is, in all sorts of ways. But when you talk about these issues of empire or colonialism, or, you know, this process of American settlement and American governance, no, it looks like a lot of other places. And, you know, this allows for these kind of comparison and contrast statements when you sort of get it out of just seeing it in this Louisiana silo. And again, I'm from Texas. I'm well aware, you know, Texans have their own little silo when they talk about their history too. But, you know, I think that's one of the ways, you know, that outside perspective really helps.
Now, describe the difference of the Louisiana frontier that makes it an anti-adversarial frontier.
You sometimes, talking about American frontiers or American settlement, you tend to conjure up this issue of Native Americans and settlers coming in and trying to eliminate populations or assimilate populations. You've also got frontiers with other nations. And, you know, this is sort of one of these problems in, again, it always comes down to the wording, right? I mean, Americans, when the Americans talk about frontier, they're often talking about it as process, right? Sort of a process of settlement and Americanization, and that the frontier is moving. But, you know, frontier in Europe often just meant the border, right? The border between two of these nations. So the United States, when it gains Louisiana, then is inheriting this border with Spain, where you don't have clear borders between them. You also don't have large settlement. I mean, you've got Natchitoches in Northwest Louisiana, but you don't have a lot of large population centers in Western Louisiana. Spain, likewise, doesn't have a lot of large population centers in East Texas. So you've got a border that's not clearly defined, and both are trying to establish, you know, their legitimacy in that region without, you know, real settlements there. So they're both competing with one another for influence among Native Americans in that region, trying to chart the region and all the rest. So, you know, so what you have in Louisiana is sort of this unique situation where, you know, you're worried about, you know, a fellow nation state actor in Spain. But you're also worried about, you know, sort of the asymmetrical threat of Native Americans in that region. And this creates a real problem. I mean, you've got situations where sometimes Spanish soldiers cross over that boundary. You've got situations where, you know, Spanish soldiers are sometimes taking stuff from American citizens now, right? I mean, often French speakers in Western Louisiana that, you know, now might be harassed by those Spanish soldiers. And because neither side can really exercise authority in this sort of this no man's land, even though they're both claiming it, you've got bandit groups, native groups operating there, you know, relatively free to engage in raids and crimes and the like as well. You've also got Spain trying to encourage people to leave American Louisiana and settle in Spanish Texas. So you've got that to the west. You've also got Spain to the east, and that they're continuing to hold on to Baton Rouge and, you know, what in Louisiana are called the West Florida parishes until you have an American or an Anglo-American revolt there in 1810. So you've got a Spanish adversarial threat from both the east and the west. And it's, I mean, there's sort of an assumption often in Washington and in Congress that Spain's a declining power and that eventually this is all going to belong to the United States. And you can certainly pick up that sentiment, but at the same time, you've often got local officials in Louisiana and Mississippi very worried about Spanish machinations in that backcountry. So, you know, you sometimes have this, you know, what seems like a bipolar approach, right? That Americans are not worried about Spain, but, you know, locals on the ground are often very worried about Spanish intrigue. And you've got a lot of Louisianans who've just been under Spanish rule. Some of them are still in contact, with Spanish authorities. So, and this is, you know, one of these things that also raises American fears, especially before, say, the failure of the Burr conspiracy, and that they're very worried that those French-speaking Louisianans are not local, that if Spain did invade, that this is potentially a fifth column. Now, most of this turned out not to be the case, but that doesn't mean those fears were just sort of absurd. I mean, we do have cases of Louisianans still communicating with Spanish officials.
Tell us about the racial order and the politics of that time period.
Yeah, so you're talking about a U.S. government that is coming in that, because of some of these worries about local loyalty, white French-speaking loyalty, there's maybe a brief moment of opportunity for free persons of color in Louisiana. They have these free companies that the Spanish had allowed, and when the Americans come in, they are very quick to, you know, put the eagle, you know, sort of symbol in their hats, and they write a petition to Claiborne and the American government saying they want these free persons of color units to continue to exist. And, you know, 1803, 1804, you've got letters from, you know, James Wilkinson, who was sort of the commanding general of the U.S. Army and, you know, there at the takeover, and Governor Claiborne, talking about how, well, they seem on board. They seem very gung-ho about the United States. They seem really loyal, whereas, you know, you contrast that with a lot of local white Francophones. They often were complaining, you know, that they weren't getting their full rights and all the rest. So in some ways, you know, for those first couple of years, free persons of color maybe seem like real allies of the American government coming in. And, you know, certainly Claiborne and, you know, the War Department allow you to recognize those free black units. And you end up with a lot of protests from white Anglo-Americans, but also white Creoles who are not comfortable with that. So, you know, there is sort of this triracial order where, you know, certainly Claiborne and Wilkinson seem to understand that, look, we can't treat the free persons of color population or ignore this group in a way that they sometimes were in other regions. Now, over time, this gets significantly worse for free persons of color and slaves in Louisiana. So 1806, you have a black code put in that's significantly stricter than what had been in place under the Spanish. Likewise, when they passed the Civil Digest in 1808, that you know, has further restrictions on this. So, you know, I mean, on the one hand, it is coming into closer alignment with what you see in much of the rest of the United States. On the other hand, you still have, you know, this population of free persons of color. They're still recognized. And so you do have sort of a simplistic kind of tripartite sort of division in, I guess, American officials' minds. Now, it's more complex, obviously, in that you're talking about indigenous peoples. And you know, again, sometimes these are triracial individuals. But, you know, it's a racial order that starts to resemble more the rest of the United States the longer it goes on. And again, some ways this is much more bottom up than it's just Anglo-Americans pushing it on Louisianans, right? In a lot of ways, this is white Creoles or white locals that, you know, from the forefront are talking about how they want to continue to be able to import slaves from Africa, even though Congress is telling them they can't. These are, you know, again, often white Creoles talking about how they're not comfortable with these free persons of color militia companies. So, you know, it's one of these things where we sometimes sort of romanticize Creole resistance to Anglo-Americans coming in. But when you look at the federal government, in some ways, the federal government's much more moderate on these issues than the local population is, the local white population is.
Now, you talked about the Indian agent, Dr. John Silvey. Tell us about him. Interesting.
Yeah, so Silvey's an interesting figure in that he's, and this is true of a lot of Indian agents of this period, and that they're not all, I mean, these are not, you know, sort of early 20th century civil servants, right? I mean, simply somebody that is well-liked by Jefferson, but he's someone who had fled, seems to be coming to Louisiana. And again, a lot of Anglo-Americans are coming to Louisiana for, you know, mercenary reasons, or they're running away from something. And Sibley's sort of abandoning his family, his wife and children, by all accounts, and coming in. And he gets this appointment as an Indian agent. He starts operating out of Natchitoches. And you know, they don't hear about the rumors about the abandoning the wife and kids till later. But when Jefferson finally does get word of them, Jefferson, you know, sort of writes back that, well, look, we don't know whose fault it was. Was it his? What is it hers? But Jefferson likes the reports that he's sending back. And, you know, by all accounts, Sibley is taking the job pretty seriously. You know, he's a good diplomat. He's good at, you know, getting out of Natchitoches and sending people out of Natchitoches to the west into that kind of Spanish borderlands area between the United States and Spanish territory, and trying to secure at a minimum native neutrality, right? If there ever was a conflict between Spain and the United States, at a minimum, you want the natives there to stay out of it. But even better, could they start coming closer to the United States? And, you know, one of the ways you're doing that is through gifts and trade. And this is another, I mean, again, Sibley's not a civil servant the way we sometimes imagine them. All these guys usually have a lot of side hustles, or maybe the Indian agency is the side hustle, right? I mean, a lot of his time is spent, trading with the natives for his own benefit. Sibley's someone who, again, is an excellent source, not just for what's going on in those native borderlands, but he's also someone who gives you a real insight into what's going on in Natchitoches. And Natchitoches is sort of that key area or jumping off point for everything to do, with that borderland zone. Likewise, I mean, you've got one of these situations where slaves will often flee from Natchitoches in western Louisiana to Spanish territory. Spanish officials seem to be giving them freedom. When American officials kind of complain about this, the Spanish will often deny it or say these are just sort of officials acting outside their real instructions. But you regularly have this happening too. And again, Sibley's an excellent source for all that stuff as well. So he's a real character. It also speaks to sort of this idea of the moving of the frontier, because by the end of the War of 1812, you've got a lot of locals in Natchitoches that don't want that Indian agency there anymore. They want it moved further to the west. They don't like visits by Native Americans into Natchitoches anymore. So, Sibley's experience also kind of speaks to this idea, the moving of that western frontier, right? That, this period of greater, fluidity or cooperation or whatever you want to talk about in terms of race and these interactions is coming to an end by 1850.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Now, you talked about the 1811 slave revolt by Charles Desalon. He was sentenced to death. That was an interesting story. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so this is maybe the largest slave revolt in U.S. history, not in terms of the number of casualties, but in the number of participants, maybe. So it's a very big thing. And this takes place up in the German coast, so areas that had been settled by Germans just upriver from New Orleans. And it highlights a lot of these issues when you talk about white Creole landowners or slave owners' fears, right? There's constantly this worry of slave revolts, and even more so in the aftermath of Haitian independence. So, and that's something that you regularly see everyone bring up in the Gulf Coast. When they talk about slave revolts, they always bring up the horrors of Saint-Domingue or the horrors of Haiti and, the potential for all this could be. So, they successfully take over plantations and start marching towards the city. Now, they're stopped short of the city. Local militia organize and, you also have contingents of, U.S. Navy and the U.S. Army at New Orleans that then move up. It probably would have been put down just with local militia without the need for U.S. troops. But the fact that those U.S. troops are there in New Orleans is one of these ways that's demonstrative of how the U.S. can be of help to local white French-speaking landowners, right? That's a useful backer. It's also the case that, it's the federal government under Claiborne that have been pushing for militia reform year after year after year, saying we need more regular practices. We need to find people that aren't showing up for militia practice. And, territorial legislature had not been particularly amenable to any of that. It's going to be expensive. It's just one more burden for local officials that are going to have to do. They're not interested. But, that slave revolt finally moves them. Now the territorial legislature gets off the dime on this. It's another way the federal government sort of, reveals itself, or the United States reveals itself, to be serious about what they see as security threats. It's also interesting that the free persons of color militia units volunteer for this too. Now, they don't march those units towards the slave revolt. They leave them to defend New Orleans, but it also speaks to these racial divisions, right? That there isn't necessarily you can't assume there's going to be blanket support for slave resistance from that population of free persons of color. So they're also in some ways demonstrating maybe their loyalty or getting greater buy-in during this too. And in the aftermath of it, once it's put down, you've got these courts that quickly execute ugly judgments. And again, cutting off the heads and putting them on poles down the Mississippi. So it's very ugly. But after that initial wave, you see the usual kind of friends helping one another out. Slaves that were caught up in the revolt that are of particular value or who you have a connection with. You see people writing to Claiborne trying to get them an exoneration, to let them loose. And so after this initial wave of executions, you then start seeing people being pardoned. And that's typical too. And it's typical of the way U.S. governance works there. They often will talk about kind of the law being applied blindly and it's going to be by the book. But, the political realities are always, judges are important figures that want their slaves pardoned. They're going to have their slaves pardoned, right? Regardless of whether they were in that revolt or caught up in that revolt or not. So, I think it's a useful kind of window. I mean, I don't know that the local militia were probably capable of putting this down on their own. But, again, it makes maybe local white elites look at the U.S. government or the federal presence as a useful backstop, certainly.
The Cantrell family. Now, this was a good example of the mixed legal system. Tell us a little about that family.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, Michelle Cantrell is someone who is a local official in the Acadian coast. And, when the Americans come in and they're trying to implement a U.S. jury system and trying to shift everything to a common law system, and you want local judges that already have status and bona fides in their area, their region. They're going to get support, especially in heavily populated regions. So in northern and western Louisiana, you'll see more Anglo-Americans appointed, right? More outsiders coming in and getting appointments. But you see a lot more locals getting appointments in southern and eastern Louisiana. And Cantrell's a local. They know he's popular. He has local support, and they want him to be a judge. But Cantrell doesn't have much of an understanding of this common law system, and most of the even getting the texts right. I mean, most of the texts dealing with common law are going to be in English, and even if you could read English with some facility, a lot of those texts are, is going to be like me trying to read ancient Greek, right? It doesn't work. There's a lot of individuals saying, well, look, I don't really want to take this position. And Cantrell, has the support, and he's well liked by Claiborne, and he's well, liked by his local constituents. And you've got this legal case where Cantrell's son-in-law, his name's escaping me, it might be Anselm, but Cantrell's son-in-law is charged with assault or assault and battery, and Cantrell goes ahead and, gives him the guilty verdict and, sentences him to a real fine and a little jail time. And Claiborne loves this, and Claiborne writes about it in letters to Jefferson and others, talking about how this demonstrates the superiority of the U.S. legal system, how the law is going to be applied without any bias when it comes to important figures or their family members or all the rest, and the fact that we have Cantrell sentencing his son-in-law after he committed a crime, how wonderful this is. But then a couple weeks later, Claiborne pardons his son-in-law. So he doesn't write effusively about that to Jefferson, right? So, there's on the one hand sort of this and again, Claiborne's a natural politician, and he wants Jefferson to like him. And, he's sort of a natural people pleaser. So, I mean, he's always selling himself and the U.S. successes to Jefferson, as you'd imagine he would be. But, the reality is something more complex, right? I mean, the reality is often, we're still going to abide by the same rules, right? That there's still going to be, different rules for different people. And that's one of the ways imperialism works, right? Different rules for different individuals, but that's one of the ways you're getting buy-in also, right? Someone like Cantrell can also then say, look, this system is okay, right? I mean, I'm still getting, my privileges, right? That, the governor's still, letting my son-in-law loose after I obey the forms. And when you give students examples like that, they sometimes think it's the most horrible kind of hypocrisy. And I can see that, right? I mean, for, idealistic young people, that of course it looks like hypocrisy, but that's often the way things work on the ground, right? And without that hypocrisy, maybe U.S. governance doesn't work, right? If you keep Cantrell's son-in-law in jail, maybe he doesn't want to continue to cooperate, give his name or fill these positions anymore. So, you need that. And same thing with Native American diplomacy and crimes, right? You'll have Claiborne tell Native American tribes after, they're caught murdering a U.S. citizen, whether French speaker or English speaker, that, the U.S. is going to enforce the laws and, you killed this many people and anyone guilty of it is going to be executed. But then Claiborne will turn around and pardon those individuals or, a number of those individuals. So there's a lot of this sort of, the form is more important than the reality, right? That we have to pretend that this is the case. But again, the reality on the ground is always much more complex. But again, if it's not complex, it probably doesn't work, right? American governance probably wouldn't work if you didn't have this kind of hypocrisy.
Now, in your book, you gave a really interesting description of Louisiana in the 1850s versus Utah. Can you tell the audience briefly about that?
Yeah, and that's one of these things where, and I think these comparisons made the book stronger, I hope. I mean, it was when I was first circulating drafts, I'd have people read it and say, why don't you just put something in the introduction about how this is like America elsewhere? So that's what I did. And not surprisingly, when the anonymous readers came back, they said, look, you say you're going to do this in the introduction, you didn't do it. It's sort of me doing, that kind of hypocrisy, I'm guilty of too, right? I always tell my students to do that, but then I hadn't done it for my own book in that way. I said I was going to do something, I didn't do it. So I went back and, looked at all these other territorial experiences. And Utah's really interesting is a comparison because you're talking about Anglo-Americans there, but in a lot of ways, that's even more foreign than, French speakers in Louisiana or Spanish speakers in New Mexico and California or, French speakers in the Illinois country, because there you've got Anglo-Americans that, you know, speak a common English language, but have a culture that in some ways is much more different than it is. And, you know, and it's one of the reasons why Utah has this very long territorial period, right? Because, you know, for, you know, you're talking about a very Protestant United States and you know, Louisiana's territorial period, again, some Catholics in Maryland and elsewhere, but, you know, an overwhelmingly culturally Protestant nation that's very uncomfortable with, you know, a Catholic majority and whether those Catholic citizens could be good Americans, right? Whether they could be good small R Republicans. But, you know, even so, pretty fast, right? I mean, you know, Louisiana becomes a state by 1812. Utah is left out for decade after decade after decade. And, you know, again, it's anti-Mormon prejudice in the same way that, you know, even more virulent in some ways than anti-Catholic prejudice, you know, for its period. But also polygamy, right? Which again becomes a major issue. So I mean, I think that's, and again, it's a useful comparison in that Utah, we sometimes get into this game of saying, well, this is Anglo-Americans that don't, you know, are somehow fundamentally different from, you know, French speakers. And not so much as you might think, right? Again, Utah's territorial experience is significantly more arduous than anything, you know, Spanish speaking or, you know, French speaking whites are encountering in those territories. So I think, yeah, I mean, Utah's really interesting in that way.
Now, I want you to tell us about Claiborne and the yellow fever. That was a fascinating story.
Yeah, so Claiborne has just horrible luck with it. And well, it's not even unique to him in that you're talking about Anglo-Americans coming in to the Gulf Coast. And again, it's not just New Orleans, everywhere in the Gulf Coast. This is the case in, you know, coastal Mississippi and Alabama and Florida too. But you have these seasonal yellow fever epidemics every summer and early fall. And for people that had had no exposure to this, it can be incredibly deadly. So you've got people coming in, you can look at, briefly in the book, I've got this portion about James Wilkinson and the U.S. Army experience one of these yellow fever epidemics, and it just ravages, you know, those units. And Claiborne is coming in, and his first wife dies in one of these yellow fever epidemics, and, you know, young child, the second wife dies in one of these yellow fever epidemics. So Claiborne had, you know, and he got it himself. His, you know, his private secretary got it too and died, but his private secretary got it too and said Claiborne's on death's door, that he might not last, and Claiborne pulled through. But Claiborne had, you know, this experience, which, again, it's sort of hard to imagine, right? I mean, again, losing your wife and young child and then losing another wife in this experience. And in some ways, yellow fever actually could be good in that, or no, I don't want to say could be good, but had sort of this you know, silver lining in that Claiborne, and they don't know it's carried by mosquitoes, right? The popular view at the time was it was carried by vapors, but they connected that to kind of swamps, right? Standing water in areas like that. And in an urban area, it's going to be that much worse, right? They're going to have that many more people with it. It's going to spread that much more quickly. So Claiborne was convinced, as were many others, that you needed to get out of the city in early summer or, you know, summer and early fall. And he made a regular practice of that, and he encouraged other people to do the same, especially Anglo-Americans coming in. He'd tell them not to arrive during that period, because if you just arrive after the journey, you already might be weakened and you might have exposure to this. And the silver lining is that meant he had to go out of the city during those periods, and he'd make these tours, the countryside. And that's one of these key elements. And again, New Orleans is so important, of course, right? It's the urban center. It's the political center of the territory, you know, it's the territorial capital. But it's not where the majority of the population lives in Louisiana in the territorial period. And When Claiborne has to leave the city, then he's got to go tour these countrysides and, you know, check in with locals and go to different regions. And that's incredibly valuable in terms of FaceTime with local officials. And, you know, it's hard to find anyone who's particularly impressed with Claiborne, you know, especially in, say, those first 5 years of his administration in Louisiana, or even those, you know, those views from Mars, even those outsiders like Robin are not impressed with Claiborne. But he's a pretty good politician. And he's good at working people. He's good at being amenable. And he wants to be liked, right? Like most politicians, that's really important for him. And, you know, that kind of FaceTime and these kind of tours of the countryside gives, you know, Claiborne a greater ability to know, you know, the territory he's supposed to be governing, but he's making these connections. He's seeing who he likes, who he doesn't, who locals seem to like, who they don't. And that serves a really valuable role. Yeah, it's another one of these areas where even though, you know, the city of New Orleans, the territorial legislature do not want to throw any money at this problem, but you do have, you know, Claiborne and others saying, look, we need to do something about standing water in New Orleans. We need to do something about sanitation here. So often it doesn't go anywhere, but they're aware that, hey, if we could, you know, drain some of this water away, you know, we might have you know, a less severe yellow fever season every summer and fall.
Now, what is the overall message you want the reader to leave with when they finish your book?
I want them to, well, personnel matters more than policy. And that's the key message, that, you know, the policy can be ignored, subverted, compromised in order to make something work. So, And that's what I'm trying to do. We're now on our fourth generation of historians doing kind of history from below. And there's been a tremendous amount of work, good work done on that. And it's created a lot of sort of little lost worlds that are interesting. But I don't know that it's necessarily brought all that many insights into how politics work. And I think you need to do it from the middle. Right. I mean, by looking at local elites, people that are exercising power, right, those kind of guys in the middle, the people who have to translate the policy to make it work on the ground, you know, that's sort of where the rubber meets the road. I think, you know, when you're looking at political processes, I think it's that implementing population that's the key population. Right. Because Congress and, you know, the administration in Washington will sign the bill or craft the policy and think they're done. Well, no, it's not done if it's not working on the ground. And to make it work on the ground, it often has to be altered in significant ways. So, you know, we sometimes talk about Americanization. And again, there's a lot of truth to that as a phrase. But, you know, this is not Americanization coming on from high. It's compromised all over the place. So in a lot of ways, when you look at territorial history, I'm trying to read it from kind of a colonial history perspective, right? That, you know, this idea that, well, no, there's a lot of compromises on the ground, that these categories are never as discrete as we think they are. And when you look at how it's working, you know, it's the personnel that make it work or don't make it work, but they rarely make it work by enforcing the policy strictly. You know, it's got to meet the local population where they are at, or bring them at least part of the way along. I'd also like you to take the message from the book that you should buy more copies. But otherwise, the main message is the personnel matters more than policy.
Well, I've taken up enough of your time. Can you tell us what is the next project you'll be working on?
Well, I've got kind of a personal project. My great-grandfather, my great-grandfather, I think pretty clearly did murder somebody. He was moving somebody's goats off of his land, or what he thought was his land, but what the other person thought he had leased. And when they came out to stop him, he and a special Texas Ranger ended up shooting someone. And that then went to a murder trial. That went to the Texas Supreme Court. And he got another trial. He had a former governor of Texas, Dan Moody, representing him. So, I'm hoping this will, I think it has sort of these elements that, it's a murder, it's Texas Ranger stuff. I think it should, you know, get published. And I'm, And I've got a built-in cache of letters. I've got two boxes of letters I'm still going through from him. So I'm excited about it. I think it should be. I think it's something people are going to want to read.
Well, we're going to be looking forward to that project. Thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Oh, thank you so much. It was a lot of fun.